Imagine for just a second that you are holding like a little plastic USB thumb drive.
Okay, just a cheap one.
Yeah, exactly. Just a cheap standard thumb drive. And you're walking down the street, you trip, and the drive slips out of your hand.
Oh no.
Right? It bounces off the concrete and it falls right down a storm drain. It's just gone.
That is a terrible feeling.
It is because you stare down into that dark water and you realize you just permanently vaporized $250 million.
Poof.
Irrecoverable.
Just completely gone forever.
Right. Because in the traditional banking world, that scenario is literally impossible. I mean, you lose your debit card, you just make a phone call, and they mail you a new one.
Yeah, it's a minor inconvenience.
Exactly. But in the world we are exploring today, it actually happens. Fortunes are literally lost in landfills because someone threw out an old laptop. So, welcome to the deep dive. Today, we are exploring the absolute wild west of alternative assets.
It really is a completely different universe from traditional stocks and bonds.
It totally is. But real quick, before we jump into the matrix, this deep dive is brought to you by CertFuel. They've got a full Series 66 course with adaptive study quizzes, smart flashcards, and like unlimited practice exams that are weighted just like the real thing. Check it out at CertFuel.com.
Nice and easy.
Yeah. Okay, so let's set the mission for today. We are tackling the final unit in packaged products and alternatives. Specifically, we are looking at other assets, and I really want to set the stakes right at the top for you, the listener. You are staring down 17 questions on this section of the Series 66 exam.
That is a massive chunk of your score.
It is, and a huge portion of those questions are going to hinge on the concepts we are breaking down right now.
And you know what makes this section so notoriously tricky for test takers is that it requires a fundamental shift in how you view the financial world. Up until this point in your studying, you've been living in like the comfortable, highly regulated house built by the SEC.
Right, where everything makes sense.
Exactly. You know what a stock is, you know what a bond is. But this unit forces you out of that house and into a vast ongoing battle. It is the epic legal and financial battle between what is a security and what is not a security.
And I mean, it sounds like a boring categorization exercise, right? Like sorting laundry. Who actually cares if we call it a security or a commodity?
You'd think so, yeah.
But the regulatory consequences of that distinction are like absolute life and death for financial professionals.
Right, because that single distinction dictates who watches over the market, how the assets can be legally marketed to the public, what disclosures are required, and what happens when an investor gets defrauded. The rules just completely change depending on the label.
And our promise to you today is that by the end of this session, you are not just going to memorize a dry list of rules. Rote memorization is honestly a terrible, stressful way to study. We're going to make sure you understand the why behind the rules.
Because when you understand the historical context and the actual mechanics of these assets, you become completely bulletproof on exam day.
Exactly. The test makers can throw the weirdest, most obscure hypothetical scenario at you, and you'll just smile because the underlying logic will just be obvious to you.
So, to begin, we need to completely leave the realm of corporate boardrooms, dividend yields, and, earnings per share.
Let's do it.
We are going to start with the oldest traded assets in human history. We are talking about the tangible world, commodities, futures, and a very specific government agency called the CFTC.
Right. And to understand why the CFTC even exists, I think we have to ask a very basic question. Why isn't everything just handled by the SEC? I mean, the SEC is the big bad sheriff of Wall Street. Why do we need a totally separate regulator for commodities?
That is the perfect place to start, actually, because it gives you the historical why. You have to look at where these two agencies were literally born.
Okay, lay it on us.
So, the Securities and Exchange Commission, the SEC, was born in Washington, D.C., and heavily focused on Wall Street in New York. It was created after the stock market crash of 1929 to oversee paper certificates, shares of companies, corporate debt. It was entirely focused on capital formation for corporations.
Just paper promises.
Exactly, intangible paper promises. But commodities trading wasn't happening on Wall Street. Commodities trading grew out of the agricultural hubs of the American Midwest, specifically Chicago in the 1800s.
The Windy City.
Right. Chicago was the great railway hub. All the wheat, the corn, the cattle from the western frontier flowed into Chicago to be priced and then shipped east. And before standardization, farmers would just roll up to Chicago with a wagon full of rotting grain and try to haggle in the muddy streets.
Oh, wow. That sounds chaotic.
It was incredibly chaotic. Prices swung wildly from day to day based purely on how many wagons happened to show up.
So the commodity markets were literally built out of the dirt to solve a physical supply chain problem.
Precisely. In H.R. 48, they formed the Chicago Board of Trade to standardize this chaos. And because trading physical goods and the contracts for the future delivery of those goods was so fundamentally different from trading corporate stocks, it required a totally different rule book.
That makes total sense then.
Yeah. Decades later, the federal government officially recognized this by creating the Commodity Futures Trading Commission, or the CFTC. So the SEC watches the corporations in New York. The CFTC watches the raw materials, historically centered out in Chicago.
Okay, so let's clearly define what lives in the CFTC's jurisdiction. When we say commodities, what are we actually talking about here?
We generally break commodities down into three major buckets. First, you have agricultural commodities. Think wheat, corn, soybeans, cotton, coffee, sugar, live cattle.
Classic farm stuff.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Second, you have energy, that is your crude oil, natural gas, unleaded gasoline, heating oil. And third, you have metals: gold, silver, copper, platinum.
The stuff the world is physically made of. And the way you analyze these assets is totally different, right? Like if I am analyzing a stock like Apple, I am looking at a balance sheet. I'm looking at their debt-to-equity ratio, the cash flow, who the CEO is, what their new product pipeline looks like.
Right, very corporate metrics.
Yeah, but if I am analyzing a commodity, let's say soybeans, I am basically just staring at the Weather Channel. I'm looking at rainfall patterns in Brazil. Or if it's crude oil, I'm looking at geopolitical tensions in the Middle East or shipping lane blockages.
Exactly right. Because unlike a stock, a commodity doesn't produce anything. A barrel of oil doesn't invent a new iPhone. A bushel of wheat doesn't declare a quarterly dividend.
I would love it if my wheat paid dividends.
Right. But their value is driven entirely by the primal forces of global supply and demand. And because the physical world is incredibly unpredictable, droughts, hurricanes, wars, supply chain shocks, the prices of these commodities can be violently volatile.
Which brings us to how they are actually traded. Because I want to invest in corn. I am not backing up a dump truck to my suburban driveway and filling it with actual corn.
No, you definitely shouldn't do that.
That would invite a lot of raccoons. The vast, vast majority of this market happens through what are called futures contracts. And to make this stick for the exam, we need to introduce our first recurring character. I want you to picture Farmer Fiona.
Let's set the scene for Fiona.
Farmer Fiona is a hardworking agricultural producer. She has hundreds of acres of beautiful golden corn in Iowa. Now, let's say it is May. Her crop has just been planted and it is looking incredible. The soil is perfect.
Sounds great for her.
But Farmer Fiona is terrified. She is losing sleep. Why? Because if the weather stays perfect across the entire Midwest, every single farmer is going to have a massive bummer crop.
Basic economics right there. If supply skyrockets, the price plummets.
Exactly. When harvest time comes in October, the market will be absolutely flooded with millions of tons of corn. The price of corn might crash to levels so low that Fiona can't even cover the cost of her tractor diesel and her fertilizer. She faces massive existential business risk simply because the weather is too good.
She needs a way to protect her livelihood.
Right. And that is where the concept of hedging comes in.
This is a critical term for the exam. Farmer Fiona is a hedger. She uses the futures market not to gamble, but to transfer her risk. So in May, she sells a futures contract.
Okay, and what does that contract actually do?
This contract is a legally binding agreement. It says, "I, Farmer Fiona, promise to deliver 5,000 bushels of corn in October, and the buyer promises to pay me exactly $5 a bushel, no matter what the market price is on that day."
So she has locked it in.
She has absolutely locked it in. She has successfully hedged her exposure. If the harvest is massive and the market price of corn crashes to $2 a bushel in October, Fiona doesn't care. She still gets paid her guaranteed $5 a bushel based on the contract she sold in May.
That's a huge relief for her.
Yeah, she isn't doing this to get filthy rich on wild market swings. She is doing it to smooth out her revenue so she can confidently plan her year, pay her loans, and actually sleep at night.
Okay, another classic example the exam loves to use for hedging is an airline. Let's say a major international airline is looking at their balance sheet, and jet fuel is by far their biggest variable expense.
Obviously.
Right. If a geopolitical conflict breaks out overseas and crude oil prices triple overnight, that airline goes bankrupt. They can't suddenly triple the price of airline tickets that people already bought months ago.
So the airline takes the opposite position of Farmer Fiona. The airline buys crude oil futures contracts. They lock in a price to purchase oil 6 months from now at, say, $70 a barrel.
Smart.
Yeah, because if a war breaks out and oil spikes to $150 a barrel, the airline is protected. They get to buy their oil at the contracted $70 price. They have capped their costs. They are hedging.
So both Farmer Fiona and the airline are hedgers. They actually deal with the physical commodity in their daily business operations. But here is the critical logical leap we have to make for the exam. If Farmer Fiona is selling a contract guaranteeing the delivery of 5,000 bushels of corn,
someone has to buy that contract.
Exactly. And the airline is buying a contract for millions of gallons of unrefined crude oil. Someone has to sell that contract. Who is taking the other side of these trades? Because it's probably not someone who actually wants 5,000 bushels of corn dumped on their front lawn.
Right. And this brings us to our second vital character, Speculator Steve.
Ah, Steve.
Speculator Steve is the necessary counterweight to Farmer Fiona. Skip lives in a basement apartment in New Jersey. He has never worn overalls in his life. He has never touched a corn stalk. He certainly doesn't own an oil refinery. Steve is taking positions in futures contracts purely to profit from price movements. He has absolutely no underlying business need for the physical commodity.
So Steve is basically just a professional risk taker.
He is. He is providing liquidity to the market by absorbing the risk that Farmer Fiona is trying to offload. Let's say Steve is looking at his weather data in his basement and he thinks a massive historic drought is about to hit the Midwest. He believes the corn supply is going to be decimated.
Okay.
So in May, he buys Farmer Fiona's contract. He agrees to pay her $5 a bushel in October.
And what is Steve's grand plan here? Because, again, he doesn't have a silo to put this corn in. Where is he putting it?
Steve's plan relies on the mechanism of how futures contracts are settled. The vast, vast majority of futures contracts are closed out before the physical delivery date ever arrives.
Oh, okay.
If Steve is right and a terrible drought hits in August, the market panics. The going price for corn skyrockets to $8 a bushel. Now, Steve holds a contract that allows him to buy corn for only $5. That contract is suddenly extremely valuable.
Because he can buy it below market value.
Right. So before October rolls around, Steve simply sells his contract to someone else in the open market, pockets the massive profit, and closes out his position. He never takes physical delivery of a single kernel of corn. He just profits off the math.
Okay, I want to pause right here. Listeners, I have a direct question for you.
Right.
Think about the scenarios we just laid out. Think about the why behind the trade. If a massive international airline purchases millions of dollars in crude oil futures on the Chicago Mercantile Exchange, are they hedging or are they speculating? Take a quick beat to answer that in your head.
Have you got it?
They are hedging. Even though they are buying futures contracts on an exchange, they actually need the oil to run their jet engines. They have a physical business need. They are reducing their operational risk. Now, if Speculator Steve bought those exact same oil futures from his basement, what is that?
That is speculation.
Exactly. Same asset, completely different intent.
And this leads us to one of the most historically fascinating and, frankly, highly testable aspects of speculation. Because the exam wants you to understand the sheer scale of the risk involved here. Speculator Steve is using leverage.
Leverage is key.
Very. When he buys a futures contract, he doesn't put up the full value of the corn or the oil. He only puts up a small fraction called the initial margin. This means a small move in the price of the commodity can result in a massive percentage gain or a catastrophic wipeout loss.
Oh, we have to talk about the Hunt brothers. If you want to understand the extreme dangers of speculation and leverage, there is no better historical case study than Nelson Bunker Hunt and William Herbert Hunt in the 1970s. This is the ultimate how not to trade commodity story.
It is absolutely legendary. The Hunt brothers were Texas oil billionaires. In the 1970s, inflation in the United States was totally out of control. The purchasing power of the dollar was plummeting. The Hunt brothers decided that paper money was doomed and they needed to put their vast wealth into a tangible commodity.
And they chose silver.
They chose silver. But they didn't just want to hedge against inflation. They wanted to literally corner the global silver market.
They wanted to own it all. Every ounce.
Exactly. They started buying silver futures contracts in massive, unprecedented quantities. But here is where they deviated from standard Speculator Steve behavior. Remember how we said speculators usually close out their contracts before delivery?
Right. They sell the paper before the corn shows up.
The Hunt brothers didn't do that. When their contracts expired, they actually demanded physical delivery of the silver.
They were chartering specialized Boeing 707 airplanes, filling them with literal tons of silver bars, and flying them to secret vaults in Switzerland under armed guard. I mean, it sounds like a James Bond villain plot.
It really does. And because they were taking so much physical silver off the market, the supply dried up. The price of silver skyrocketed from around $6 an ounce in 1979 to nearly $50 an ounce by early 1980. They were worth billions on paper. But they were using massive amounts of borrowed money leverage to maintain their futures positions.
And the regulators finally stepped in, right? Because they break the market.
Yes. The commodities exchanges and the regulators realized that the Hunt brothers were creating a systemic risk to the entire financial system. So the exchanges abruptly changed the rules. They severely restricted the use of margin for silver purchases. Suddenly, the Hunt brothers couldn't borrow any more money to keep buying.
Wow.
And without their constant buying pressure, the price of silver began to fall.
And because they used leverage, when the price fell, they got hit with margin calls. Their brokers demanded more cash to cover the falling value of their positions.
But they had all their wealth tied up in physical silver in Swiss vaults. They didn't have the liquid cash to meet the margin calls. This triggered a massive panic sell-off, famously known as Silver Thursday in March 1980. The price of silver crashed. The Hunt brothers were ruined, eventually declaring bankruptcy.
It is the ultimate cautionary tale of how the leverage in futures contracts can destroy even billionaires.
Truly. And it perfectly illustrates our next major exam concept, the regulatory divide. Because the Hunt brothers were trading physical silver and silver futures, they were operating in a world entirely separate from the stock market. Therefore, they were not regulated by the SEC.
This is an absolute cornerstone concept for the Series 66. The SEC oversees securities, equities, bonds, mutual funds. Commodities, physical goods, and commodity futures contracts are overseen by the CFTC, the Commodity Futures Trading Commission.
Different sandbox, different rules.
Listeners, engrave this in your mind right now. The exam will try to trick you. They will give you a long, super complicated scenario about a farmer trading pork belly futures or an airline trading heating oil futures and ask you which agency has regulatory jurisdiction. Option A will almost always be the SEC. Do not click option A. The SEC does not care about pork bellies. The CFTC is the sheriff of the commodities town. But let me push back on this for a second. Let's make it a bit more complex, because the exam will. What if speculator Steve decides that day trading futures all by himself in his basement is just too stressful? He keeps getting margin calls and he's exhausted. So he goes to 10 of his basement buddies and he says, "Hey, give me your money. Let's pool all our cash together into one giant pot. I will manage the pot and I will use it to professionally trade crude oil futures for all of us."
Okay, interesting.
That sounds exactly like a mutual fund. And mutual funds are regulated by the SEC. So who regulates Steve's new operation?
It's a great question, and it's a very common exam trap. You are right. Mechanically, it functions very much like a mutual fund. But the regulatory jurisdiction is determined by the underlying assets being traded inside the pool. Because Steve is pooling money specifically to trade commodity futures, this entity is not legally a mutual fund. It is legally defined as a commodity pool.
Commodity pool.
Okay. Yes. And speculator Steve, who is managing the money and making the trading decisions, is acting as a CPO, a commodity pool operator. Because the underlying assets are under the CFTC's jurisdiction, the commodity pool itself, and Steve, as the CPO, must register with the CFTC, not the SEC.
This is so important that we need to contrast it directly. Let me break this down. If you have an investment company that pools money from 1,000 investors to buy shares of Microsoft, Amazon, and Tesla, that is a mutual fund. The underlying assets are corporate stocks, which are securities. Therefore, the mutual fund is regulated by the SEC.
Exactly.
But if you have an entity that pools money from 1,000 investors to trade wheat, silver, and cocoa futures, that is a commodity pool. The underlying assets are commodities. Therefore, it is regulated by the CFTC.
The underlying asset dictates the regulator. It is a really elegant rule once you see the logic behind it.
Okay, that covers the broad, sweeping world of agricultural goods and energy commodities. But I want to zoom in on one specific subcategory of the tangible world. We touched on it with the Hunt brothers, but we really need to go deeper because it presents its own unique matrix of exam questions. Let's talk about the shiny stuff, precious metals.
Oh, yes. When we transition to precious metals in an investment context, we are generally talking about the four kings. gold, silver, platinum, and palladium. And to understand how they are tested, you first have to understand why investors allocate capital to these metals. Why not just put all your money into a high-growth tech index fund?
Right, because fundamentally, a shiny rock does absolutely nothing. I mean, if I buy a share of a bank, I hope the bank makes smart loans, generates profit, and pays me a dividend. If I buy a share of a pharmaceutical company, they might cure a disease and the stock doubles. But if I buy a gold bar, it just sits there. It is completely inert. It doesn't invent anything. It doesn't pay a dividend. So what is the actual utility of owning it?
The primary utility of precious metals, specifically gold and silver, is that they act as a hedge against fiat currency devaluation and inflation. And to truly understand that, we have to look at a brief piece of monetary history. Up until 1971, the United States dollar was actually backed by gold. You could theoretically exchange your paper dollars for physical gold at a fixed rate. This was called the Bretton Woods system.
So the paper money was just like a convenient receipt for the actual gold sitting in a vault.
Exactly. But in 1971, President Richard Nixon abruptly severed that link. This was the Nixon shock. The U.S. dollar became a purely fiat currency, meaning its value is based entirely on the faith and credit of the U.S. government, not on any tangible asset.
And the problem with fiat currency is that the government, via the central bank, can essentially print an infinite amount of it.
Correct. When the government prints massive amounts of new money to pay debts or stimulate the economy, it increases the total supply of dollars. Basic economics tells us that when supply goes up drastically, the value of each individual dollar goes down. That loss of purchasing power is inflation. A loaf of bread that cost 20 cents in 1950 costs $4 today. The bread didn't magically become more valuable. The dollar became weaker.
But a government cannot print gold.
Exactly. There is a finite, limited amount of gold in the Earth's crust. It takes massive amounts of capital, heavy machinery, and human labor to extract it. Therefore, gold cannot be arbitrarily inflated by a central bank. So historically, over long periods of time, as the purchasing power of paper money falls due to inflation, the nominal price of gold tends to rise, preserving the investor's purchasing power.
It is also the ultimate psychological safe haven asset. When there is a global panic, a sudden war breaks out, a major banking system collapses, a global pandemic shuts down the economy, people completely panic, they sell their risky tech stocks, they sell their corporate bonds, and they flee to physical, tangible assets that have held value for 5,000 years. Gold is basically the ultimate financial panic button.
And because it holds that unique psychological place in the market, test makers love to quiz you on exactly how an investor can gain exposure to it, because the regulatory lines get very blurry depending on the method. Let's bring speculator Steve back. Steve watches the news, decides the global economy is doomed, and he wants to buy gold. He has several different avenues, and you need to know the regulatory status of each.
This is the regulatory matrix. Let's walk through Steve's options. Let's start with the most basic, option one. Steve drives to a local coin dealer. He takes a stack of cash and he buys physical ownership. He walks out with heavy, shiny, 1 ounce gold bars and silver coins. He takes them home, is what he just bought a security.
No, he bought a physical commodity. It is no different legally than buying a toaster or a very expensive paperweight. It falls completely outside the SEC's jurisdiction. If there is any federal oversight of the commercial market for that physical metal, it leans toward the CFTC.
Option two. Steve realizes carrying heavy gold bars is annoying. He logs onto his computer and buys gold futures contracts on the commodities exchange. He doesn't want the physical metal. He just wants the leverage of the contract to bet on the price going up. Is the futures contract a security?
No. As we firmly established with the Hunt brothers and Farmer Fiona, futures contracts on commodities are regulated by the CFTC.
Okay, option three. Steve wants exposure to the gold market, but he wants to stay in his comfortable stock brokerage account. So he buys shares of a gold mining company. Let's say he buys equity in Newmont Mining or Barrick Gold. These are the massive corporations that own the bulldozers and employ the geologists who dig the gold out of the ground. Is this a security?
Yes, absolutely and unequivocally. He is not buying gold. He is buying equity shares of ownership in a publicly traded for-profit corporation. That corporation has a board of directors, a CEO, human resources departments, and quarterly earnings reports. It is a traditional stock. This is firmly SEC territory.
And finally, option four, the trickiest one. Steve buys a gold ETF, an exchange-traded fund, like the famous SPDR Gold Trust, ticker symbol GLD. The sole purpose of this ETF is to track the spot price of gold. The ETF buys physical gold bars and locks them in a high-security vault in London, and then issues shares to investors that represent fractional ownership of that vault. Is the ETF share a security?
Yes, it is. Even though the underlying asset sitting in the vault in London is a physical commodity, the ETF itself is a financial instrument. It is a structured fund that is registered and traded on a public stock exchange, just like a share of Apple. Therefore, the ETF is a security regulated by the SEC.
Okay, listeners, I am throwing a direct question at you to see if you map that matrix correctly. Listen closely. If speculator Steve takes $1,000, buys 1 ounce physical Canadian maple leaf gold coin, takes it home, and literally shoves it under his mattress, is that coin considered a security under the Uniform Securities Act or federal law? Take a beat. Think about it.
Do you have the answer?
Nope. It is not a security. It is a physical, tangible commodity.
Now let's talk about the brutal reality of holding that physical gold coin under the mattress, because the exam heavily tests the distinct disadvantages of owning physical precious metals. When you hold a physical commodity rather than a financial asset, you face severe drags on your overall return. The first and most critical downside, no income generation.
I love my analogy for this, so I'm bringing it out. If you compare a traditional blue chip dividend paying stock to a physical gold bar, the difference is stark. A good dividend stock is like owning a golden goose. It's alive, it does work, and every 3 months, it lays a little golden egg for you. That's your quarterly cash dividend. You get paid just for the privilege of owning it. You can take those golden eggs, reinvest them, and buy more geese. It compounds.
The magic of compound interest.
Right. But a physical gold bar, on the other hand, is just a shiny rock. It is dead. It doesn't lay eggs. It doesn't invent anything. It doesn't pay interest. The only way speculator Steve ever makes a dime of profit on his gold bar is if he finds someone else willing to pay more for that shiny rock in the future than he paid for it today. It relies entirely on capital appreciation.
Exactly. And it gets worse. Not only does the shiny rock not pay you, it actually costs you money to own it. Which brings us to the second major downside, storage and insurance costs. If Steve buys one gold coin, fine, he puts it in a drawer. But what if Steve is wealthy and buys $500,000 worth of physical gold bullion? He cannot leave that under his mattress.
The raccoons from Farmer Fiona's farm will come steal it.
Or, you know, actual burglars. So Steve has to rent a secure, climate-controlled vault at a specialized depository. He has to hire armed guards. He has to pay for specialized high-risk insurance policies against theft or natural disasters. These are ongoing, recurring operational costs. Every single month, he is writing a check just to keep his assets safe. These storage and insurance fees eat directly into his net returns year after year.
It's like having a shiny rock that you have to pay a guy named Vinny to guard in a warehouse 247. Vinny requires a salary. And then, let's say 10 years go by, and Steve finally wants to sell the gold to lock in a profit.
Mm.
He faces the third major downside, high transaction costs and illiquidity.
Right. If Steve wants to sell a share of Apple stock, he opens his brokerage app, taps a button, and the trade executes in milliseconds, often for zero commission. The market is perfectly liquid. But Steve can't tap a button to sell his physical gold bars. He has to physically transport them securely to a specialized bullion dealer. That dealer has to assay the gold to prove it isn't fake, which takes time and money. And then the dealer is going to charge a substantial markup or spread to buy it. The friction involved in the transaction is incredibly high.
So if we synthesize all of that for the exam, physical precious metals generate zero income, they drain your returns with ongoing storage and insurance costs, they have high transaction friction, and they are emphatically not securities. But a mining stock or a gold ETF is a security. Got it.
It is a critical distinction to master.
All right. Let's do a pattern interrupt. Shake it out. Roll your shoulders. Take a deep breath. We just spent a lot of time in the physical dirt with Farmer Fiona and in the secure warehouse with Vinny guarding the physical gold. Wipe the dirt off your hands. We are completely shifting gears. We are leaving the oldest assets in human history, and we are going directly into the matrix. Let's talk about digital assets.
This is a fascinating pivot because digital assets present the exact same philosophical challenge to regulators that commodities do. They often exist outside the traditional 1930s definitions of securities, but they add a massive, intimidating layer of technological complexity and cryptographic uncertainty. When we use the umbrella term digital assets in the context of this exam, we're primarily talking about cryptocurrencies, utility tokens, and anything fundamentally built on blockchain technology.
Okay, before we even attempt to look at the exam rules for crypto, we have to establish a baseline understanding of the technology. Because you hear the word blockchain thrown around constantly at tech conferences and on Twitter, usually by guys wearing Patagonia fleece vests. But the exam actually requires you to understand its core functional properties. What mechanically is a blockchain?
At its most basic, stripped-down level, a blockchain is simply a ledger. It is a record-keeping book of transactions. Who sent what to whom and when? Traditional ledgers are centralized. If you use a traditional bank, the bank owns the central ledger. They hold it on their private servers. You have to trust that the bank is keeping the ledger accurately.
You completely trust the centralized authority.
Exactly. But a blockchain is a distributed ledger. Instead of being held secretly on one central bank server, identical copies of the entire ledger are distributed across thousands, sometimes millions, of independent computers worldwide called nodes. And this architecture creates four key properties that define the entire asset class.
Let's hit those four properties.
First is transparency. On public blockchains like Bitcoin, anyone with an internet connection can view the entire ledger. You can trace the history of every single transaction all the way back to the Genesis block. Second is immutability. This is achieved through complex cryptography, specifically cryptographic hashing. Once a block of transactions is mathematically verified by the network and added to the chain, it is locked. It cannot be altered, forged, or deleted by anyone.
Wow. And the third property?
Decentralization. Because the ledger is maintained by a global network of independent computers relying on a mathematical consensus mechanism, there is no central boss. There is no CEO of Bitcoin. There is no corporate headquarters to raid. No single entity controls the network. And the fourth property, which directly stems from immutability, is irreversibility.
Okay, to make this visceral, I have an analogy that explains all four properties at once.
Yeah.
Imagine a blockchain as a magical public Google document. Millions of people around the world have this exact same Google Doc open on their screen simultaneously. Everyone can see exactly what is being typed into the document in real time by everyone else. That is the transparency.
What a great visual.
Thanks. But here is the magic, terrifying part. The backspace and delete keys have been permanently physically removed from everyone's keyboard. If you type a sentence into that document and hit enter, it is there forever. If you make a typo, you cannot erase it. Mistakes are permanent. That is the immutability and the irreversibility. And nobody owns the Google Doc, so you can't email customer support to fix your typo. That is the decentralization.
That is a brilliant way to conceptualize it. And that irreversibility is a massive, profound, conceptual leap for investors who are used to traditional finance. In the traditional banking system, if you accidentally wire $10,000 to the wrong account number, what do? You panic, but then you call your bank. You explain the clerical error. Because the bank is a centralized authority that controls a ledger, they can investigate, freeze the funds, and physically reverse the ledger entry to give you your money back. They have a delete key.
But with a decentralized blockchain, there is no 1-800 customer service number to call.
None. If you mistype a cryptographic address and send your Bitcoin to the wrong place, the mathematical protocol executes the transaction exactly as instructed. It is permanently recorded on the immutable ledger. The transaction is final. Your money is gone forever. This is why understanding exactly how you store and access your digital assets is incredibly important and highly testable.
Yes. Let's talk about wallets, because the terminology here is very misleading. When you own cryptocurrency, you don't actually hold little digital glowing coins in your hand or even in a file on your hard drive. The coins purely exist as entries on that public distributed ledger. What you actually hold, what you own, are private keys. A private key is basically an impossibly complex cryptographic password, a string of letters and numbers, that proves to the network that you have the authority to move the assets associated with your specific address on the ledger.
He who holds the keys controls the coins.
Exactly. And you store these private keys in a crypto wallet. And for the exam, you need to understand the two main categories of wallets, because they represent a fundamental trade-off between convenience and security: hot wallets and cold wallets.
Let's break them down. A hot wallet is online. It is software-based. It might be an app you download on your iPhone or an extension you run on your web browser. Because the wallet is actively connected to the internet, it is incredibly convenient. You can quickly sign transactions, trade on decentralized exchanges, or buy an NFT with just a few clicks. But that exact same internet connection is its fatal flaw. Because it touches the internet, it is vulnerable to online hackers, phishing scams, and malware.
Right. A hot wallet is exactly like the physical leather wallet you carry in your back pocket when you walk down the street. It is super convenient for carrying 50 bucks, but you can quickly buy a coffee at Starbucks. But it is exposed to the world. You could easily get pickpocketed on the subway. You would never, ever walk around a crowded city with your entire life savings stuffed into your leather wallet. It's just too risky.
Which brings us to the alternative. For your life savings, you need a cold wallet. A cold wallet is offline. It is entirely disconnected from the internet. It is usually a specialized physical hardware device that looks a lot like a USB thumb drive. To make a transaction, you have to physically plug the device into a computer, press a physical button on the device to sign the transaction cryptographically, and then unplug it. Because it spends 99% of its life offline, sitting in a drawer, it is practically immune to remote internet hackers. It is designed for the highly secure, long-term storage of large amounts of crypto.
A cold wallet is like taking your life savings in cash, locking it in a solid titanium safe, and burying it out in the woods behind your house. It is incredibly secure from pickpockets, but it's not very convenient. If you suddenly want to buy a coffee, you have to get a shovel, walk into the woods, take up the safe, spin the dial. It is slow and deliberate. Now, having explained the mechanics of these wallets, we must address the most explicit vital exam warning regarding digital custody. We talk about having no customer service if you send money to the wrong person. What happens if you simply lose your private keys? What if you drop that hardware cold wallet down a storm drain, or your house burns down, or you suffer amnesia and forget the password to decrypt your hot wallet?
Lost keys equal permanent, unrecoverable loss of the assets, period.
This is genuinely terrifying to think about, and it is a massive departure from the traditional financial system. Listeners, contrast this with your normal life. If you forget your complex password to your Chase bank account or your Vanguard retirement account, what happens? You don't lose your retirement. You click the little blue forgot password link. The centralized bank emails you a reset code. You answer a security question about your first pet's name or your mother's maiden name. The bank authenticates your identity, overrides the old password, and grants you access to your money. The central institution acts as your safety net.
But in the decentralized world of blockchain, there is no central institution. There is no password reset link. The cryptography is absolute and unforgiving. If you lose your private key, that wealth is functionally incinerated. The Bitcoin or the Ethereum still technically exists on the public ledger. Everyone can see it sitting there. But without the private key, no one anywhere in the universe, not even the smartest cryptographers on Earth, will ever be able to move it or access it again. It is locked in a glass vault for eternity.
And that profound lack of a safety net, that absolute burden of self-custody, is a key risk distinction that the exam wants to make sure you grasp as a future financial professional advising clients. But before we dive deeper into the specific risks of the crypto market, we have to address the biggest elephant in the entire regulatory room, the absolute core of this entire study unit. The SEC is pacing back and forth in Washington, D.C., looking at this massive, chaotic, multi-trillion-dollar digital asset market, trying to figure out how to regulate it. How exactly does the SEC legally decide if a specific digital coin or token is a security, and therefore under their strict jurisdiction?
Well, to answer a cutting-edge technological question about blockchain in 2026, the SEC relies on a legal weapon forged from a dispute over orange juice in 1946.
I love this story so much. Listeners, buckle up, because to understand crypto regulation, you need to understand Florida agriculture.
Enter the ultimate exam weapon, the Howey test. The Howey test stems from a landmark Supreme Court case called SEC versus W.J. Howey Company. In the 1940s, W.J. Howey owned massive tracts of citrus groves in Florida. He wanted to raise capital to expand his operations. So he came up with a clever scheme. He sold small, individual plots of land within his citrus groves to out-of-state investors, mostly wealthy businessmen staying at a nearby resort hotel.
Now, these wealthy businessmen from New York didn't want to actually farm oranges. They didn't own tractors. They didn't know how to prune a citrus tree.
Exactly. So Howey offered them a separate service contract. Under this contract, Howey's company would maintain the trees, harvest the oranges, sell the fruit at market, and then pool the profits and distribute them back to the landowners. The investors just provided the capital and sat back waiting for the checks.
And the SEC looked at this operation and said, hold on a minute. You aren't just selling real estate. You are selling an unregistered financial security.
And Howey fought back. He said, no, I'm not. I'm selling dirt and orange trees. That's real estate. And I'm selling a basic agricultural service contract. Neither of those are stocks or bonds. You have no jurisdiction here. The case went all the way to the United States Supreme Court. And the Supreme Court sided with the SEC. They ruled that when you combine the land sale with the service contract, you create a new financial instrument. the court established a four-part legal framework to determine if any scheme, regardless of what it is called, constitutes an investment contract and is therefore a security under the Securities Act of 1933.
And this framework is what we now call the Howey test. Let's break down the four prongs of the test, and this is crucial for the exam. A financial instrument must meet all four prongs to be considered a security. If it fails even one prong, it usually escapes the SEC's grasp. Prong one, an investment of money. Prong two, in a common enterprise. Prong three, with a reasonable expectation of profits. Prong four, derived from the efforts of others.
Okay, reading the four prongs off a list is dry. The exam will not ask you to just recite them. It will ask you to apply them to a scenario. So let's apply the Howey test using a brand new character. Listeners, I want you to meet tech bro Tyler.
I can picture Tyler perfectly. Tyler wears a lot of Patagonia fleece vests. He drinks artisanal, ethically sourced matcha lattes. And Tyler has a grand, world-changing idea. He wants to build a revolutionary virtual reality app where people can put on headsets and virtually rate the ripeness of digital avocados.
Yeah.
It's a completely absurd, terrible business idea. But Tyler needs funding to pay software developers to build it.
Right. In the traditional world, Tyler would have to go beg venture capitalists for money or try to do an IPO on the stock market, which costs millions of dollars in legal fees and SEC registrations. But Tyler is in the crypto space, so he bypasses all of that. He launches an ICO and an initial coin offering.
Tyler generates a billion digital tokens out of thin air using a few lines of code. He names the token Tyler Coin. He sets up a slick website and tells the public, buy Tyler Coin today for one penny. The money you invest will fund my brilliant development team. Once we finish building the VR avocado app, Tyler Coin will be the exclusive currency used inside the virtual world. And because the app will be so popular, the value of your coins will skyrocket to the moon.
Okay, let's run tech bro Tyler's scheme through the Supreme Court's Howey test. Speculator Steve sees Tyler's website, gets massive FOMO fear of missing out, and decides to buy $1,000 worth of Tyler Coin from his basement. Let's hit the prongs. Prong one, was there an investment of money? Yes, Speculator Steve paid $1,000 of his own cash. Prong two, is there a common enterprise? Yes. The legal definition of a common enterprise usually involves the pooling of investor funds, where the fortunes of the investors are linked together and linked to the success of the promoter. If Tyler builds the app successfully, Steve and all the other investors win together. If Tyler fails, their coins go to zero together.
Prong three. Is there a reasonable expectation of profits? Absolutely. Tyler literally promised on his website that the value would skyrocket to the moon. Steve didn't buy Tyler Coin because he actually wants to rate virtual avocados. He bought it because he expects 100x financial return on his investment.
And this brings us to the linchpin, the most heavily scrutinized prong, Pong 4. Are those expected profits derived from the efforts of others?
The answer is a resounding yes. Think about it. Speculator Steve is just sitting in his basement in New Jersey drinking Mountain Dew. He isn't writing a single line of software code for the VR app. He isn't doing any marketing. He isn't negotiating partnerships. All of the actual work, the managerial and entrepreneurial efforts that will theoretically drive the value of the coin higher, are being done entirely by tech bro Tyler and his hired development team. Steve is entirely passively reliant on the efforts of a third party, just like the wealthy businessmen relying on Howey to pick the oranges.
Therefore, Tyler Coin hits all four prongs perfectly. Investment of money, common enterprise, expectation of profit derived from the efforts of Tyler. The legal conclusion. Tyler's ICO is an investment contract. It is a security. It is subject to all the stringent rules of the Securities Act of 1933. Tyler cannot just sell it on a website. He must register it with the SEC, provide extensive financial disclosures, and follow strict anti-fraud rules. Because he didn't do any of that, the SEC will likely sue him into oblivion.
And this framework is exactly why the SEC chairman has repeatedly stated that the vast, vast majority of the thousands of ICO tokens launched over the last decade are unregistered securities. They almost all rely on a central team of developers making promises to passive investors. Okay, time for another direct question to the listener. We know Tyler Coin is a security. Ask yourself this. If Tyler Coin is a security because it passes the Howey test, is Bitcoin a security? Take a beat. Think about it based on the four prongs we just walked through.
Well,
does Bitcoin hit all four?
Righty.
No. Bitcoin is not a security.
And we need to explain exactly why Bitcoin fails the test, because this is a major recurring exam gotcha. You must understand the distinction. Let's run Bitcoin through the Howey test. Do people invest money into it? Yes. Do they have an expectation of profit when the price goes up? Yes. But does it meet the requirement for a common enterprise whose value is driven by the efforts of others? No.
Why not?
Because unlike Tyler Coin, Bitcoin has no central promoter. The creator, Satoshi Nakamoto, disappeared over a decade ago. There is no tech bro Tyler sitting in an office suite writing the code to make Bitcoin valuable. There is no official management team. There is no Bitcoin marketing department. There is no CEO to subpoena. There is no centralized entity whose entrepreneurial efforts dictate the success of the project.
It is just pure open source software running autonomously across tens of thousands of independent computers globally.
Exactly. The network is maintained by a decentralized web of miners who are simply following mathematical rules, not managerial directives. Because there is no identifiable third party whose efforts investors are relying on, Bitcoin fails prong four of the Howey test. Therefore, the regulatory consensus is that Bitcoin is a digital commodity, not a security. It falls closer to the CFTC's jurisdiction than the SEC's.
This is such an important distinction for the exam. Listeners, do not panic. The Series 66 exam is not going to give you a list of 10,000 random obscure cryptocurrencies like Dogecoin or Shiba Inu or Solana and ask you to memorize which specific ones are securities and which ones aren't. That would be an impossible memorization task, especially since the courts are still actively fighting about it. The exam is going to give you a scenario, much like our tech bro Tyler example, and ask you to apply the Howey test logic. If you see a centralized development team, a promoter making big financial promises, and investors relying entirely on that team's work to make a profit, it's almost certainly a security. If you see a purely decentralized network with no central management or promoter, it's probably a commodity.
This naturally leads us into our final major topic for this deep dive, the digital danger zone. Because these digital assets sit in such a strange regulatory gray area, sometimes they are securities governed by the SEC, sometimes they are commodities under the CFTC, and sometimes they operate in offshore jurisdictions completely outside the traditional U.S. financial system. We have to ask, what happens when things go wrong? And historically, things go wrong constantly in this space.
Oh man, the risk profile of digital assets is absolutely wild. If you are advising a client on putting crypto into their portfolio, you have to understand the specific risks the exam highlights. First, obviously, is volatility risk. We talk about commodities like oil and corn being volatile, but crypto is on another planet entirely. It is not uncommon for a smaller digital asset to drop 40% in value while you were asleep on a Tuesday night.
Then you have cybersecurity risk. We mentioned individual hot wallets getting hacked or pickpocketed, but the risk scales up. Entire centralized exchanges or decentralized finance protocols get exploited through complex mechanisms like flash loan attacks, resulting in hundreds of millions of dollars in customer assets being drained in seconds.
There is liquidity risk. Some of the smaller obscure tokens like Tyler Coin might have massive hype, but very little actual trading volume. So even if the price looks incredibly high on paper, when speculator Steve actually goes to click the sell button to lock in his $1 million profit, there are no buyers on the other side. The price collapses the moment he tries to exit.
Yeah.
You also have technology risk. These networks are built on complex software code, usually written in new languages like Solidity. Software inevitably has bugs. Sometimes a smart contract has a tiny flaw in the code that allows a hacker to drain all the funds permanently.
And tying into technology risk, you have the risk of forks. Sometimes the community of developers and miners fundamentally disagrees on how to upgrade the blockchain software. When they can't agree, the network literally splits in two. This is called a hard fork. It's like taking our magical Google document, copy-pasting the entire thing at a specific point in time, and from that moment forward, half the people type on document A and half type on document B. This creates two competing currencies, like what happened when Bitcoin split into Bitcoin and Bitcoin Cash, causing massive confusion and intense price swings for investors.
And of course, we can't forget pure fraud risk. Because it is so easy to create a token, the crypto space is rife with scams. You have rug pulls where an anonymous developer hypes up a project, collects millions in investor funds, and then suddenly abandons the project, deleting the website and stealing all the liquidity pool money. It makes tech bro Tyler look like a saint.
So we have a massive list of risks: volatility, cybersecurity, liquidity, technology bugs, forks, and fraud. But if we look at all these risks from the perspective of an exam writer trying to test your regulatory knowledge, there is one risk that is considered the most distinctive when compared to traditional stock market investing.
Let me push back on that, because as a regular investor, nothing feels more distinctive than 40% overnight volatility, or the fact that an anonymous hacker halfway across the world can drain an exchange and the money is just gone forever. How can anything be more distinctive than that? What does the exam actually consider the most unique risk?
The exam considers regulatory risk to be the most distinctive. Think about it systematically. If you own stock in Apple or Ford, you know exactly what the regulatory framework is. It was established in the 1930s. It is stable. The rules of the road are clear. But the regulatory framework for digital assets is incredibly uncertain, fiercely debated, and constantly evolving around the globe. Because it is so unsettled, a single, sudden government action can completely tank the value or utility of an asset overnight.
So the volatility is just a symptom. The uncertainty is the disease.
Precisely. If a major economic power, like China, suddenly announces a total ban on the mining or trading of cryptocurrencies, which they have done multiple times, the global market crashes immediately. If the U.S. Congress passes a law imposing impossible tax reporting requirements on decentralized nodes, the industry flees overseas. If the SEC suddenly files a lawsuit against the founders of a top 10 cryptocurrency, declaring it an unregistered security after years of trading freely, every major exchange will immediately delist that token to avoid being sued themselves. Liquidity dries up instantly. That level of sudden, existential, stroke of a pen regulatory threat is entirely unique to this asset class. You don't wake up worrying that the SEC is going to suddenly declare Apple stock illegal.
That makes total sense. Now, I want to hit on the final major exam trap for this entire unit, and it ties directly back to that lack of a safety net we discussed earlier regarding lost private keys. Let's look into systemic failure. Let's go back to speculator Steve. Steve has decided that he doesn't want to mess around with burying titanium cold wallets in his backyard. He doesn't want the burden of memorizing cryptographic private keys. He just wants things to be as easy as buying a stock on E-Trade. So he takes $100,000 of his own cash, deposits it onto a massive, slick, centralized cryptocurrency exchange. Let's call it Mega Crypto Exchange. And he buys Bitcoin. He leaves the Bitcoin sitting right there on the exchange platform. 6 months later, it turns out Mega Crypto Exchange was secretly being run by incompetent gamblers. The exchange goes completely bankrupt, halts all customer withdrawals, and shuts down the website. Steve is locked out, but Steve isn't worried. He just picks up the phone, calls the federal government, and gets his 100 grand back, right?
Absolutely not. And you must have this reality seared into your brain for the exam. When it comes to digital assets held on a crypto exchange, there's no SIPC protection, and there is no FDIC insurance.
Let's explicitly explain why by comparing it to the traditional systems the exam expects you to know. If Steve takes his money and puts it into a traditional checking account at a local bank and that bank goes out of business, what happens? The FDIC, the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation, steps in. The FDIC was created during the Great Depression specifically to stop bank runs. It protects fiat currency deposits up to $250,000. The federal government makes Steve whole. He doesn't lose a penny.
Now let's look at the investment side. If Steve puts his money into a traditional SEC-registered brokerage account at Charles Schwab or Fidelity, and he buys shares of Apple stock, if Charles Schwab goes bankrupt or if a rogue employee steals customer assets, what happens? SIPC, the Securities Investor Protection Corporation, steps in. SIPC was created by Congress to protect customers of registered broker-dealers. They will replace Steve's missing securities or cash up to $500,000.
But if Steve puts his money onto a crypto exchange, he is completely operating outside the perimeter of those safety nets. A crypto exchange is not a federally chartered bank, so the FDIC wants nothing to do with it. And a crypto exchange is not an SEC-registered broker-dealer handling traditional securities, so SIPC will not rescue him. If the exchange fails or gets hacked by a cyber syndicate like the infamous AntDox hack in 2014, where 850,000 bitcoins vanished, or the massive collapse of FTX Steve is simply an unsecured creditor in a chaotic multi-year bankruptcy proceeding, he faces a total devastating loss of his assets.
Now, a quick nuance. You might hear marketing from some crypto exchanges claiming they carry insurance. And that is sometimes true. Some carry private insurance policies. But the test makers want you to know that this private coverage is extremely limited. It usually only covers a small fraction of the exchange's total hot wallet assets in the event of a very specific type of cyber breach. It does absolutely nothing to protect an individual investor from a broad exchange insolvency or mismanagement in the comprehensive way that SIPC or FDIC does. The federally backed bulletproof safety net simply does not exist here.
No safety net. That is such a vital concept to hammer home. Okay, we have covered an immense amount of ground today, from the dirt of Farmer Fiona's cornfield to the cryptographic hashes of the decentralized blockchain. It is time for our outro. We are going to do a rapid-fire recap of the absolute biggest, most highly testable takeaways we've discussed. I'll start. Number one, know your regulators. The CFTC, the Commodity Futures Trading Commission, regulates the tangible world. physical commodities, and futures contracts. The SEC regulates the intangible world of securities, which includes commodity ETFs, mining stocks, and mutual funds. The underlying asset dictates the regulator.
Number two, the drawbacks of physical precious metals. They are a great historical hedge against fiat inflation, but they generate zero income, no dividends, no interest. Furthermore, they actively drag down your total return with high ongoing storage and insurance costs. And remember, holding a physical gold coin is never a security.
Number three, the digital safety net does not exist. If you lose the cryptographic private keys to your crypto wallet, it means the permanent, irreversible loss of your assets. There is no password reset. And if you leave your crypto on a centralized exchange that goes bankrupt, there is zero SIPC protection and zero FDIC insurance. You are entirely on your own.
Number four, the ultimate weapon, the Howey test. This is the 1946 Supreme Court framework the SEC uses to determine if any asset is a security. It requires four prongs: an investment of money in a common enterprise with the expectation of profit derived purely from the efforts of others.
And number five, applying Howey. ICO tokens like tech bro Tyler's ridiculous Tyler coin almost always pass the test and are regulated as securities because investors are passively relying on a central development team to drive the value. Bitcoin, however, because it is truly decentralized with no central promoter or management team, fails the fourth prong in the test and is generally recognized as a digital commodity, not a security.
Excellent recap. To close out this deep dive, I want to leave you with a provocative thought to chew on as you continue studying, something that goes beyond the memorization of the rules. We've spent a lot of time today talking about how the SEC aggressively applies the Howey test, Jason, a legal framework born out of a dispute over Florida citrus groves in the 1940s to evaluate globally distributed, cryptographically secured blockchain networks in 2026.
It's a huge disconnect.
Right. And as digital assets continue to grow and evolve into a multi-trillion dollar foundational layer of the internet, something eventually has to give. Will the rigid, decades-old Howey test eventually be rewritten entirely by Congress to actually accommodate the unique, decentralized properties of blockchain technology? Or will crypto projects be forced to completely alter their fundamental, decentralized DNA just to squeeze themselves into the regulatory boxes designed during the Great Depression? It is perhaps the defining financial question of our time.
It really is. It's like trying to regulate a faster-than-light spaceship using maritime shipping laws written for wooden sailboats in the 1800s. Eventually, the friction gets too high, and something is going to snap. Listeners, thank you so much for joining us on this session. Remember, do not just memorize the rote facts. Truly understand the why and the how behind the mechanisms. That is your ultimate cheat code for the exam. Keep grinding, trust your preparation, and go crush that Series 66.